For anyone that has followed our show or listened to a single episode, I just want to express our gratitude for your unwavering support. Today, we're releasing a very special episode featuring the late Ben Wright. Ben was an incredible trailblazer in the cybersecurity industry, and he saw the connection between legal and cyber long before many others did. He was a true giant in our industry. And this podcast owes much of its success to his pioneering work. I was fortunate enough to get to know Ben through our connection with SANS, and his course remains one of the few that have only been taught by the author. He was an extremely generous person who always made time for others, and I feel privileged to have had the opportunity to be part of an interview with him for this podcast. Sadly, this was Ben's last recorded interview. And it's a testament to his enduring legacy that we're able to share with you today. After Ben's untimely passing, we made the decision to delay the release of the second part of this interview out of respect for him and his family. But at the request of his daughter, we're now releasing it to the world. We hope that you enjoyed listening to Ben's thoughts and insights as much as we did, and that this episode will serve as a fitting tribute to a true gem in the legal and cyber industry. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Cyberside Chats from Epic, a global legal services provider. Hosted by Jarek Beeson, Chief Information Security Officer, Cyberside Chats is where professionals come to hear CISO and industry leader insights on the latest news and trends for cybersecurity and privacy in the legal industry.
Welcome to Epic Cyberside Chat, where we are excited to be developing content for and by the legal and privacy industries. There's a lot of cybersecurity content in media, but we believe there is a gap when it comes to the legal industry in specific, and we're seeking to address that with our show. My name is Jarek Beeson, and I have the privilege and honor of hosting this show for just about 2 years now. And I have my esteemed co-host, Whitney McCollum.
Hi, Jarek. As always, happy to be here. I'm Whitney McCollum. I'm a partner at K&L Gates in the Data Protection, Privacy, and Security Practice Group. This is part two of a two-part episode with Ben Wright. If you have not listened to part one, we encourage you to go back, listen to part one, or listen after you listen to this wonderful episode on deepfakes. We will be talking to Ben about deepfakes today. Jarek, would you like to give a little background about Ben for those new listeners to the show today?
Sure thing. So Ben is a fellow instructor at SANS Institute. He's also a practicing attorney from the great state of Texas. I can say that because I currently reside in Texas. He actually teaches a five-day course titled Law of Data Security and Investigations. He also advises diverse clients for privacy, electronics commerce, data security law, and he also has his own website if you want to reach out to him after the show, benjaminwright.us. And one thing I didn't call out about Whitney, she is the legal and I am the cyber, and together we are trying to join the conversation because we believe that cyber and legal really go hand in hand. And we are going to talk about deepfakes. Super excited about that. But to ground our audience, there is a necessity to explain what we mean by deepfakes. We don't want to assume that anybody knows anything. So this is my definition cobbled together from research and experience. But effectively, a deepfake is a video, an image, or a recording that has been convincingly altered and manipulated to misrepresent someone doing or saying something that they actually did not do. Now, it uses machine learning techniques to make a connection between the sound produced by the video, the subject, the shape of their face, and together, it really looks like a realistic situation. It looks like something actually occurred that did not occur. And if you go back to the history, the oldest version of deepfakes go back to the media industry. It was originally intended to help with movie dubbing to enable movie sequences to be modified to sync actors' lips with other soundtracks. Now we're seeing the potential malicious intent with, you know, creation of fake news, which is a really popular topic, and I think it'll continue to be with the election cycle coming up. But there's also opportunities for, you know, framing somebody, crime, even fraud. So that is why this is a topic that is of keen interest. It uses technology and cyberspace, but also has a lot of legal application.
I don't know if you watch America's Got Talent, Jarek, but this season, one of the finale groups is called Metaphysics, and they were an AI performance group that was based on deepfake. As a privacy and cyber lawyer, I was disturbed that they got so far in this talent competition for essentially a deepfake technology that had, they used the judges of the show and used opera singers behind the lens to make the judges look like they were wonderful opera singers. And that's an entertainment example. But today, and our discussion with Ben, we'll be talking about the cybersecurity and the legal concerns about deepfake.
That is a fascinating example. I'm going to date myself and say, I remember when Milli Vanilli was publicly shamed for lip syncing. And now
when watching this talent competition, I literally said, man, if Milli Vanilli only had this technology, and here we are embracing it when they were publicly shamed for Blame It on the Rain.
Absolutely. That is, man, I guess, you know, the world changes. And so the world changes. So we have a treat. Maybe it's a treat. There's a pretty popular video. As of the time of this recording, it has over 9 million views. It is from 2018, which is important to note because we are 4 years later, meaning technology has gotten that much better. But this is a deepfake video of somebody impersonating the president and having him say some things that we obviously know he wouldn't say. So take 10 seconds. This is only a small clip of the video. If you want to hear the entire video, it has some language that is not necessarily one that we want to share on our show. But if you want to watch the whole video, you can definitely check out the link in the show notes. So we're going to take a second away so you guys can listen to this clip.
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. So, for instance, they could have me say things like, Killmonger was right. You see, I would never say these things, at least not in a public address, but someone else would. Moving forward, we need to be more vigilant with what we trust from the internet. That's a time when we need to rely on trusted news sources.
Okay, so if you've seen the video, you know what we cut out. But if you haven't seen the video, it is impressive how much that sounds like President Obama. And if you're watching the video, it's even more impressive how much it looks like he is saying the things that he is saying. Whitney, what is your take on this?
It scares me all day long. It scares me. And I think the fact that it was 4 years ago and looking at that video, and then here we are now in 2022, where we've come a lot farther with misinformation, the fact that mis and disinformation are part of our vernacular now, and quote, fake news is an allegation, it scares me because. And while we'll get into this a little bit with Ben on deepfake as evidence, I think the reality is that it leads to a general mistrust of the truth. In addition to the risk of lies, it causes people to not believe and understand the truth. And I think that's the real risk for society. And then from the legal standpoint, the biggest worry is Ben's going to talk about all the different ways that you can undermine deep fakes and how in a court of law, there's different technologies and uses, and we rely on the rules of evidence and authentication for proof. But I think also the reality is once information is out there, even if the truth is proved later on, it's really hard to undo people's impressions and beliefs. And so I have a high degree of concern about deepfake information and how it's going to be used in various ways. I think that current war in between Russia and Ukraine is a prime example of risks of misinformation as well. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with you, and for so many reasons. Our very first guest on the show was Michael Mangold, and he is the head of risk at YouTube. And one of the things that he talked about was the management of disinformation being on his radar and one of the things he has to deal with. I don't know at the time if deepfakes were high on that list, but I would imagine with YouTube being on there, it's definitely one of the mediums that these deepfake videos are going to be propagated on. And you're right. People believe what they hear. People believe what they see. If people can't believe what they hear and see, it creates an existential risk inside of somebody. What am I if I can't believe what I'm hearing and if I can't believe what I'm seeing? So I can't imagine. It also makes me think that 16-year-old Jarek would have gotten in a lot of trouble with this technology. A lot of trouble. So I can think of so many applications just putting on my 16-year-old hat, which makes me wonder some other things. But the reality is if you have the ability to make someone think they're seeing something they're not seeing, that you're wielding a lot of power with that. And if you couple that with hearing something that they're not hearing at the same time, you're going to influence a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And some people are going to use it to influence for good, and they're going to get someone to donate a bunch of money to a charity that they probably shouldn't donate because they think that Kim Kardashian told them to, right? But then there's going to be a whole another set of people there and get people to do things that they shouldn't do because they think someone else told them to do that as well. And it's inevitable. I don't know how massive it's going to be, but technology that's used for good has consistently turned into technology that was used for bad. And that is why cybersecurity exists. That is why privacy exists. So I'm excited. Let's bring Ben back and let's hop into the conversation with him and hear his legal perspective on it. So Ben, being the legal cyber whiz that you are, you're actually up to date on some of the modern emerging. You know what? I say it how I see it. And I've seen some stuff from you. I know you're on top of the emerging threats as well. And there's one that really stands out to me, which is deepfakes. I know that video evidence and pictures have been the linchpin in a lot of cases. And with the advent of deepfakes, I'm wondering if the integrity of videos and pictures is going to come to question and how the legal community is planning on addressing it, or what you think they should do to address it.
All right. So yes, integrity of video and pictures and audio and so on will come into question. When I approach this problem from a legal perspective, I see history and I say, wait a minute, have courts ever dealt with counterfeit evidence, fake evidence? Oh yeah, from the beginning of time, courts have dealt with witnesses who lie. Courts have dealt with pieces of paper that appear to have a signature on them, but they're fake. And courts always have struggled with understanding the authenticity of any kind of evidence. And a major problem with evidence from the Dark Ages is people can sit on a witness stand and say blah, 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 and they don't remember what actually happened. And so as technology changes and we migrated from paper documents into electronic mail and then text messages and web pages and so on, again, courts had to wrestle with those kinds of questions of, is this email authentic or is it not authentic? The same kinds of problems will come into the courtroom increasingly as so-called deepfake technology is available to make a video that appears to show one thing when it's just fake. It's created by artificial intelligence. An observation that I have about this kind of deep fake evidence is that normally in a legal context, there is time to evaluate the evidence in great detail. That means, for example, you take the video, you show it to an expert, and the expert picks it apart to see if there are any little artifacts in the video that give a hint that this really is not President Obama with the American flag behind him saying something crazy. It's really just an artificial intelligence creating something that looks like President Obama saying something crazy. So in a court system, in a court, you don't just, you know, have this deep fake and then within 25 seconds, then the court has to decide, is it true, is it not true? That's not very common. Now, deep fakes have been used in situations, and successfully used in situations where somebody has to make a decision on a snap. And so there is a story out of Dubai where a very sophisticated deep fake voice program over the telephone persuaded a banker to release $35 million through a wire transfer, where the banker believed the banker was actually talking to the banker's corporate customer. But decision by a banker is very, very different from the decision by a court, because you file a lawsuit, there's time that goes by before you actually have hearings, and once a lawsuit gets going, then there's time to go hire an expert and review the deepfake evidence and evaluate, is it true, is it not true? There's another aspect to evidence that goes into a courtroom, and this all became very clear when we started using electronic mail to do business, and that is that any kind of evidence has to fit within a historical context. And so if you've got a video of President Obama saying something in front of an American flag, the question is, where was President Obama at that precise moment? What was he doing? And President Obama is a pretty public figure, and there's a lot of evidence out there about, well, President Obama was over here, or President Obama was giving a speech over there, or President Obama was on vacation or over here or there or whatever. He's a well-documented figure. And therefore, if you try to say, well, he made that video at that particular instance, you could probably pretty easily find evidence that says, no, President Obama was not there doing that. He was over here, giving a speech or something. And therefore, the deepfake is just obviously out. It doesn't fit within the context of history. And so, as we've learned how to use electronic mail for forming contracts, there is that possibility, and people do bring electronic mail into the courtroom, claim that it's authentic when in fact it's not. But in order to succeed with this fake electronic mail, you've got to show a historical context. Who sent the email? Where were they? What were they doing at the time? What does the audit trail show? What other communications were happening between the parties at that time? And on and on and on and on. And all of this contextual information, historical contextual information, has a big impact on being able to confirm whether a particular electronic mail is or is not authentic. And so I think basically the same kind of process will help us when some bozo tries to bring a deep fake video into the courtroom and say, well, because of this, somebody owes me a bunch of money.
So, Whitney, please jump in after this, please. I'm a strong believer that the best communicators can take very complex topics and explain them to the layman. When it comes to the legal world, I am the layman, and you explained that perfectly. I know you could use a lot of legal jargon when you did that, but if I were to sum up what I think I heard, framing via deepfake is going to be a lot harder because of the analysis stage. You can identify anomalies, you can correlate context such as location, but deepfake-induced crime and how we handle those, that's a different story, because fraud and all the other forms of getting humans to do things that they maybe shouldn't do unintentionally, seems like deepfakes are going to have a have a role in that as well.
I like your perspective of this concept is not new to human nature. We have the tools to question it. And as technology increases and make deep fake seem even more real, we also have increased technology tools to question and counter. I think that's a great point.
I'll say one more thing while I'm on my deep fake soapbox. That is, in the American legal system, there is enormous incentive not to bring false evidence into the courtroom. Because if you bring a deep fake, you bring a fake email, you bring a fake document into the courtroom, and you have reason to believe that it's not true, and you present it as truth, you can go to jail. And so there's we have a lot of pressure through the American adversarial legal system to tell the truth in the courtroom. Otherwise, your adversary is going to work hard to prove that you're a liar and that you knew that it was a deep fake, and your adversary is going to try to not only get your evidence kicked out, but actually cause you to be referred to the local prosecutor for perjury.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think one thing that is getting lost these days, and we don't have time to get into it, it's really a not even just one whole other episode. I think it's a whole lifetime of discussion, is the reality that the court of public opinion is making the first case now, and our justice system is taking the time and taking the energy to really dig into the facts, but people are jumping to conclusions far too quickly and sharing information that hasn't gone through the due process rules. But I'm personally confident that we can find a healthy balance between the two states.
So you make a point, and once again, this is Jarek, the ignorant cyber guy trying to talk legal here. Is there a possibility that creation of deepfakes can be considered slander? Because you're right, in the court of public opinion, people will immediately believe what they see. It's going to take a lot longer to get them to unbelieve what they've seen, and it could really tear down someone's life if the wrong thing is depicted in a deepfake. So is there potential legal grounds for slander or something like that?
I was going to say that the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial was very closely followed around the world, I think partially because of that notion of you can say something about someone that can really affect their life and what happens in that case. And of course, celebrities and domestic issues and all the drama that was behind that. But the core of it was, what happens when you tell the truth about someone and the public believes it? And what's the legal repercussions?
Yeah. Yes. And so my advice to deep fakers is be careful before you create a deep fake that has harmful effect on society or other people. Watch out. There could be indeed legal liability associated with that.
Thanks, Ben.
All right. I think that's a great close to the show. This was a great conversation. I knew it would be. Ben, once again, thank you for sharing your expertise and your time with us. One last question from a closeout perspective. Is there anything that large organizations need to do? Do they need to start creating standards from a legal perspective when it comes to cyber? What should organizations do to just make sure that they are managing their cyber legal risks like they're managing all their other cyber risk?
I have a perspective on how organizations should talk about their cybersecurity work. And I don't hear too many of my peers saying the same kind of perspective. And essentially it's this. When I view larger organizations dealing with cybersecurity, I view them as not solving cybersecurity. You don't solve it. You're never going to be, quote, secure. You're never going to get there. But what you can do is that you can apply professional teamwork to the problem. And I use this standard of performance professional teamwork in a way that analogizes to what I see in a hospital during a COVID surge. Hospitals do not guarantee, oh, you got COVID and we've got a surge and we've got some new variant, come to us and we guarantee you're going to survive. Hospitals don't talk like that. And cybersecurity teams and organizations should not say, we guarantee we're not going to have a breach or an attack or an intrusion or something like that. Instead, what I see organizations doing is they have professional teams and they apply professional teamwork similar to the teams that at a hospital. Even when the hospital is under stress and is short on staff, short on knowledge, short on resources, and I think that's what organizations are today. They're short on staff, knowledge, talent, resources in a very, very difficult environment that could be analogized to a COVID surge. So kind of my last thought here is that as organizations describe what they do in policies and contracts and public communication, instead of saying we comply with cybersecurity requirements, I'd say the organization should say we have a professional team constantly working on cybersecurity problems.
And that analogy is pure gold. I love that. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for all your discussion today. It's really valuable.
Ben Wright, everybody. Thank you once again.
It's been an honor to talk with you guys.
You as well.
That's all for now.
Until next time.
Thanks for joining us today. If you have any questions or ideas from today's show, share them with us by emailing cyberside@epicglobal.com. Don't forget to follow us on socials. You can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram by searching for Epic Global. Until next time, stay cyber smart.